Hello, I'm Rory McKiernan, author of Hitching for Hope and host of the Love and Courage podcast. And you're very welcome to this, the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. We have a great episode coming up for you in just a moment. Before we get started, can I encourage you, when you're finished this episode, be sure to check out the archives of the podcast. Some great material, some great conversations in there waiting for you to enjoy. And a big thanks to all of you who support the podcast in so many different ways, and to Creative Ireland for their support. My guest in this episode is Tara Darlene Smith. Originally from California, Tara is a writer living and working in North Clare, a place she truly loves, as you're about to hear. Writing has always been a great passion for Tara, something that helps her explore her emotional world and the world around her in general. And in this episode, she shares with me how, after considerable challenges in her youth, she ended up joining the US military and going to fight in the war in Iraq. She talks openly about some of what she has been through and about how County Clare has been a huge part of her journey to healing, transformation, and indeed creativity. Tara is currently working on a memoir, which I'm really looking forward to reading when it's published, and she continues to publish work on her website, taradarlenesmith.com, which is worth checking out. So let's jump in and get going with this Creative Souls of Clare conversation with Tara Darlene Smith. Tara, you're very welcome to the podcast. I want to start by asking you a very ridiculous question, because I've known you sort of on and off to say hello to and have the chats. But like in Ireland, we say Tara, and I'm wondering, do you say Tara, or like, do you say your name different than we say it to you?
Well, I used to say it like Tara, but then when I moved here, I was informed by Roisin Garvey that I was saying it wrong my whole life.
Okay.
And she said, no, it's Tara.
So you've adopted it?
I have. And I don't feel like I do it on purpose anymore, but it's something that sort of changed the longer I'm living here.
So this is fairly symbolic of everything, really, perhaps.
Yeah. There's a lot in the name, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you had this Irish name, but yet many people also have that name in different countries. It's not an Irish name for them. It could be an Indian name, for instance. Right. And I suppose that's maybe a starting off point, is to ask you, is it like, do you have Irish heritage?
Well, like a lot of American tourists come over here and talk about, I've discovered we all kind of all sound the same, where it's like my great great grandparents used to live in this village and that makes me Irish, right? It's that kind of way.
But do you have that?
I do, but okay. It's distant enough to where I wouldn't be able to tell you much. A few names have been thrown around, and I think it's just because there's a disconnect between the generations, you know, after enough time passes. But yes, you have Irish heritage.
I mean, I feel that you're slightly taking the Irish side on that, in that I'm not fully convinced that it's fair all the time that we dismiss it, you know, because many or most of us have grown up here, and that's changing by the day with demographics and so on. But many of us grow up like, we're from Ireland. All our family are forever from Ireland. And that's the way it is. And then we sort of almost like dismiss that quest for, or that pride in roots and identity, and go, well, you're not really Irish, or it's diluted, or you're not sure. I don't know. Like it kind of is what it is. Like it's, yeah. I don't think we've any right to, because the fact is, like, anyone that's ever left this land, there's a very high chance they had to leave because of, you know, war, injustice, poverty, oppression, or the quest for adventure, you know. I don't know. It's like you're part of that. But I also love the homecoming aspect to the multi-generational, like particularly in Irish music, and maybe less so in literature, but certainly in music, like the intergenerational aspect has continued to reinforce. And now we have like Irish Americans coming back with better music than some of the people here. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I have told people that when I arrived in Clare, at least, that I felt more at home here than I ever felt where I'm actually from.
Yeah.
And it was a gut feeling, like it was in my bones, and it's not something that I ever expected. And so there must be something to that. Whether I actually had family that ever lived in Clare before or not, it was like there was something about this place that just felt like I'd been here before. But I can't even explain it. It's just a felt sense. But I do feel like that matters, that there's something in that, even if I'm not the only person to say it or feel it.
That's interesting. I like that as a felt sense. It doesn't need to be like an intellectual knowing or a memory. It's like the body knows at some level, I guess it's where the DNA rubber hits the road, you know?
That's it. Yeah, it felt like it was much bigger than myself. And I love to intellectualize. So when I get the opportunity to not, that feels like a gift.
Yeah, yeah. So where you are from, I think I recall you telling me once upon a time that you're from around Mount Shasta or Shasta in Northern California. Is that correct?
It is and it isn't. My family is mostly in the Sacramento area, and that's where I was born.
Okay.
And I lived there until about halfway through high school, secondary school. And then we moved up to Mount Shasta and I finished out school there. And so I kind of feel like I have two hometowns in California, and they both have been very significant to me in terms of growing up, but they're so different. Like Sacramento's a city, Mount Shasta's teeny tiny rural, you know, so very different feels, but I feel like a hybrid in that sense. I can appreciate city life and I love country life, and I love being exposed to both. Do you know the way some people only know one or the other?
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, you know, elements of possibly more so up towards Shasta direction, like it would get a bit colder, you know, than the typical image of hot California, but it's certainly not the weather that you would now have as we speak. The wind is howling out the window in the west coast of Clare. How do you feel in terms of the change in topography and elements and just the landscape around you? Is that sort of felt sense? Is that part of the land? Are you feeling something with the land?
I never felt like I fit in Sacramento for that reason. My family would say, well, if you drive a few hours, you're at the sea. If you drive a few hours, you're in the mountains. But I'm like, what about where we actually live?
Yeah.
So it's strip malls and oppressive heat in the summertime. And to me, it's like a reverse winter where you're basically stuck indoors with the air conditioning because it's just nasty out, and the traffic and the noise and all of that sort of thing. And so living northern, you know, even more northern in California, where there were mountains and rivers and lakes. And then I did live in Humboldt County when I went to school there. So that's right on the coast. And it would be similar to Clare, rugged and green and all that sort of stuff. So I felt like I thrived in those environments more so than the one I was actually born into. Mm-hmm. But I was surrounded by people who just were like, this is great. I love air conditioning and being inside all the time. So when I came here, I felt like I was more free to just soak up all of this rain and wind and ruggedness because it, you know, it's just such a, you know yourself, there's no place like it. It has a similar feel to places that I've lived, but there's no place like this. And now I sound like Dorothy, right? There's no place like home.
Oh, a little bit. but it like is home. You're like speaking at a level where I sense that you're not leaving, as in, you know, because there is that thing with, particularly if somebody has a different accent, of which somebody once told me that 18% of people in Clare, actually, you know what, them in terms of the census, that's probably true. 18% of Irish people weren't, 18% of people in Ireland weren't born in Ireland. So that's a huge number.
Yeah.
Now, most of them, well, a lot of those could be like Irish people that were born in London and then moved home or whatever. But I have heard it said that Clare has a very high ratio of people from different countries and so on. So often there's this like feeling that if somebody has a different accent or is from abroad, that they maybe are going to be moving again or moving onwards. But I'm not really getting that sense from you at all.
No, I've waited my whole life to feel this way. And I can remember when my grandfather passed just about 3 years ago, and we were chatting, and I had said to him, do you know, I wish that I felt like Sacramento, because you're all here. I wish I felt, you know, about Sacramento like I do about Ireland, but I don't. I never fit here, but I fit there. And he said, as long as you're happy, that's what matters.
Yeah. So is that bittersweet then in
Absolutely.
Terms of,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm so grateful to be here, and there's this ache that's ever present because there are nieces and nephews and aunts and uncles and, you know, cousins and people that I'm not going to see very often because there's an entire massive country between us and an ocean, and technology only gets you so far, right?
Yeah.
But I was not at home there, and I wasn't willing to stay so that I could watch everybody else thrive and live the lives that they wanted to while I just felt so off kilter.
Does that feel like a no-win situation? Because, I mean, it feels like the ideal for anybody would be to love where they're from, and therefore they, presumably not everyone does, but a lot of people do love their family and their community. So there's a split there that you just have to manage. And I mean, that's the story of a lot of migrants and refugees and immigrants all over the world forever and ever. It's that tension that is it, do you find peace with that, or, you know?
I feel that I'm thriving here, and it's not to give Claire all of the credit, but there is this really delicious alchemy that I feel like that's happened with who I am, where I'm at within myself, and when I came here. And so my family and my friends back home, so to speak, they see that and they're delighted for me. And they know that that's not how I was able to live when I was there. And so the more peace I feel within myself, I could take this show on the road. I could live anywhere, but I'd rather be here. Mm. I'd rather have this be my home base and dip back to visit and know that that love is there no matter how far apart we are. So I feel, yeah, that there's peace within it. It doesn't feel like tension. I've known that sense, I feel like you're speaking to, but that's not what I feel now. I'm just acknowledging that I'll probably always miss people in places. But isn't that true of anybody that's ever left where they're from? Do you know, like that would come up because you have a basis of comparison, right? Like you see other things in other people. And then let's say you go back home and then you miss the place that you went on a holiday to. Like you can go down that rabbit hole, right?
Absolutely. So I'm kind of getting a sense that, you know, home life had a lot of merit in and a lot of love in it in terms of family and your grandfather and different family members, but it certainly wasn't a place you were thriving. Can you just maybe paint the picture of what life was like for you growing up in that region and that community, or both those places?
Well, it was tough. And we moved a lot, and there were a lot of marriages and divorces within my nuclear family, so to speak. So a lot of instability. And I feel like I didn't realize this until much later, but I grew up in survival mode, and we didn't have a lot of money, and everything just felt like it was a struggle, but that was all that I knew. Mm-hmm. So then when we moved yet again to Mount Shasta, in that area, it was so beautiful that I feel like nature stepped in and really did a lot for me. And I got to understand like how powerful that can be to live somewhere calm and quiet and gorgeous. And so things remained unstable and tough, but I had nature on my side. Whereas growing up in a city or in the suburbs, you don't necessarily have access to that. And this is me before I was 16 or 17 and could drive and go other places myself. Like, you're kind of at the mercy of where your family lives, right? Your world's a bit smaller when you're much younger. So when it came time to really try and make a way on my own, like, I left home when I was 16, and it was to stay in Mount Shasta when my family once again picked up and moved back to the city. They left and I stayed. And that was a really pivotal time for me, but I was so broke. And I was just trying to finish high school and then try to start college. And I struggled for 5 years just to make ends meet. And so at that stage, that's when I started looking into the military, because what I was doing wasn't sustainable, you know, 3 or 4 jobs as a waitress or a maid or whatever. And I felt like everything that I wanted to do was getting further away from me. And all of a sudden, there was this opportunity for a whole different way of doing life. So as much as I love my family, and I really do, one of the greatest things about them is they've taught me what I don't want. And so when I left, you know, at 21, I've basically, with rare exception, been gone ever since. So I suppose that discussion of being at peace with being away is something that's taken a long time for me to come to. So yeah, I feel like I'm going on and on.
You know, the military aspect is obviously a point of interest, particularly, probably for many people, but certainly it's not a huge point of reference for Irish people because our military is so small. We don't have like a massive military culture. It is there. I grew up in a town that had a army barracks, so I had plenty of friends that their parents were in the army and they were on peacekeeping missions in Lebanon and elsewhere. So it wasn't completely alien, but for the most part, it's not a massive part of our DNA, you know, and that's very different in the US. And one of the reasons, at least my understanding from having spent time in the US, foreign policy has a lot to do with it, but poverty has a lot as well. And I mean, that's what I was hearing when you were speaking, is like you weren't looking necessarily to join the military. You were looking for a way out of your situation. Is that right?
Absolutely. But it was layered in terms of, I was fresh after 9/11. So that was a huge element of the context in terms of like patriotism and feeling confused and stressed and helpless. And like, this is something that I can do. I think we've all had that sense of overwhelm when you see, whether it's a natural disaster or a war or something, and you just want to help. And you don't even know how. And this was a step in that direction. So it felt like it would tick a lot of boxes, that I could help my country. That's how I saw it. I could help other people. I could help myself all in one. Mm. If I just showed up and worked and did my part, then everything else would fall into place. Like, that was how I saw it.
Yeah.
But I realized now in retrospect that what I was really craving was community and a sense of connection. And like I said, my family, they did their best, but I did better when I was away from them.
Yeah.
And so I still wanted that structure, that sense of stability, all of those things. And the army was like a big shiny poster that offered all of that. So it was far beyond sort of being in the ether of the culture. It was, it ticked a lot of boxes going. But I had a different idea of what it would be then versus now, of course, you know. So you could say that about anything, right, as you get older.
So, Tara, listening to you speak, I can't help think back to my own life, because I was in some ways living a very different existence. I was living in the northwest of Ireland in Donegal, and I was getting very sort of, not necessarily politicized, but also wanting to do something. And hearing about the Iraq war and, you know, the messaging that we were receiving was certainly the weapons of mass destruction and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, obviously the information that was coming out from certain sources around who was behind it and so on and so forth. But anyway, the moral of the story is that I was getting involved in like peace activism. So I was many ways on the absolute opposite side of the fence.
Right.
And maybe that's for another day, but I'm just kind of curious then, and because since then I've also met a lot of veterans and come to realize that behind every veteran is a very different story than the collective unit known as a military or the army. And often people coming home have seen different things or have different ways of being or seeing. So I'm just wondering, that person who left, what the person who returned, how different were they?
Well, I have to admit that I earlier today was listening to your podcast episode where you're speaking with Barry, aka Luke Bloom.
Okay, yeah.
And you both were discussing this very thing.
Oh, were we? I must listen back myself.
I was laughing myself about how that sense came on, like, wow, we're all friendly now. We all live in the same place. But at that point in history, we were on different sides,
not
to pit against each other. But I have friends here now who were actively protesting. Do you know, like, my first time in Ireland was coming through Shannon on my way to Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, and now I know people who were at that airport protesting me being there.
Yeah.
Not specifically, but I understand, like, it's, you know, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how we all ended up in the same place, right? But I just wanted to acknowledge that I've heard, you know, I suppose like the Irish side of it, if that's a fair way to say it. And it was one that I can tell you I was completely unaware of at the time. If you guys were out there protesting, we sure as hell didn't know about it. So I went into it a certain way, and I liken this, whether it's fair or not, I liken this with parenting, because I still don't have kids. And when people say, I couldn't do what you did, what was it like, how was it? And I say, the military in general, let alone war, you can have an idea of what you think it's going to be like. You could even watch movies, read books, but nothing prepares you for it like being in it. And then I'm like, is parenting like that? And most parents have said to me, like, yeah, it is. People will tell you all day long how to be, but you just figure it out as you go. And so the person that came back was a mess, and I say that with love. I was absolutely shattered on so many levels and didn't even realize it. So there was a lot of unpacking to do, and I feel like in some way I might be doing that for the rest of my life. And how I understand things now is from a place of self-compassion and love and understanding that I was doing my best at the time. And I just finished a piece and put it up recently called Sunflowers in Iraq. And so far, it's my favorite thing I've written because it's the most honest I've been able to speak about that experience. And I wrote this line about the underbelly of patriotism is ignorance. And I was blinded by mine. And that is not a very American thing to say, but it's how I feel now, that I had this idea, this intention that we were there to help. And yet it didn't seem like that at all once we were actually there. So there was no time to reconcile that when you're getting shot at, but it's now that I'm here and safe and clear. The point of the story really was about how I can ask those questions and also sit with the fact that I may not ever have answers about what it all meant and what it was all for. And another line that I wrote was that I could fill 1,000 pages with all the things that I don't understand. But the difference between who I was when I came back versus where I'm at now is that I'm more at peace with the not knowing.
I look forward to reading that.
Thanks.
So I'm wondering, it's hard not to see how the writing is therapeutic. And was writing always something that was there for you, or was it something that found you, or you found it?
Oh, it's been with me my whole life. And I didn't bring much to Ireland when I moved here, but I did bring a suitcase full of journals. And some of them are so old that they have crayon in them. And I'd write my little stories about wishing I owned a horse and that sort of thing. So I've always loved reading, which I feel like always fed my writing. And like a lot of people do, I started out copying things that I loved, and then eventually finding my own voice along. And I have my journals from the whole time I was in the military and beyond. So I feel like writing has been with me my whole life. It's one of the few constants that I have. And when you're healing, I think that that's crucial. For me, it's writing, but it's something that I did before, during, and now in the after. If I was to break my life up into those, you know, milestones, the military was only in for 4 years, but it was a very impactful 4 years. So, like I said, something that was with me all throughout is huge. You sort of cling to those things, but I feel like the more I've gotten to know myself and understand where I'm at, the more the writing seems to resonate with others. Like, it goes bigger picture. It's not just about me and my healing. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does, absolutely. I think you captured it very well in how you covered it. So, like, could you sort of, without necessarily getting into the specifics, I'm trying to get a sense of you in Iraq, and are you writing in the darkness? You know, are you like in the middle of the night waking up as a, or do you, have you got a notebook or a journal with you? Like, how does this play out?
Well, my grandmother, she was a writer, and she sent me this tiny little moleskin journal, and it was the first one I ever had. And it was small enough to fit in my cargo pocket, like that was on my uniform. I had that in a pen with me at all times. So wherever I could scribble something down, I would. Whether it was on a break from a convoy I was driving on, you know, the different places along the way. But then whenever I had time to myself, which maybe wasn't for long, I would stop and just write either in that journal or in others. But I remember being really afraid to say how I actually felt. So when I go back and look at those journals from being in the military the entire time, the whole 4 years, I censored myself a lot. And I know this, that what I didn't say says a lot more than what I actually wrote.
Yeah, down. Yeah.
Because I was afraid that somebody would see it.
Of course. Yeah, you're in a live war. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That strikes me as holding a lot of fear, that you're afraid of those that are potentially going to attack you, but also maybe fear of your own friends and superiors. And, you know, it's was there a sense of feeling like a sort of a dissident in, you know, that the critical thought wasn't allowed, for instance?
Oh, it was absolutely not allowed. Yeah. And that was something that they would break us down in basic training to build back up. And they told us that.
Yeah.
The built back up version was in their likeness, not mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't really me. I was there doing a job and serving my country. And you did not speak badly against anything. You just did what you were told.
Mm.
So if I had any idea about asking questions or trying to figure out what we were even doing there and all these things around that didn't seem to make any sense, like if we're here to help, then why are we getting shot at? If somebody is shooting at you, they don't want you there. So it's just these things that you, like I said, you couldn't really reconcile, but there was no time or space to really sit with that for very long. And even if you could, you would get into trouble. It was completely not allowed to ask those kind of questions. So I just didn't, but I was afraid of everything, really. And then I think most of my energy and effort went into not showing that.
Yeah. Like, you were ultimately a very young woman by any standards, and a young woman anywhere in any town, any city is trying to find out who she is and who they are and get a sense of their place in the world. But you're trying to do this in a war zone. And so this return home, then I'm curious what home was and what we don't need to talk about, you know, it maybe says enough to say that you were a mess. But I'm curious then how your journey progressed in terms of the healing, the understanding, the writing, and then ultimately, where did Ireland come into all of this?
Well, it's telling that when I came home, I didn't go to Sacramento. I went back to Mount Shasta because it felt more nourishing to be there. And even though my whole family, like I said, was still down in Sacramento, but I needed to be somewhere that I could breathe. And I leaned into school. I can say that that was another one of those constants for me that I had before. I did take the odd class when I was in the military from a distance. Like, I would have to do them painfully slow, but I maintained going to school while I was in. And then getting out, I had the GI Bill. So that was a game changer. And all of a sudden, I didn't have to work three jobs and go to school. I could just go to school and maybe work a part-time gig. And so I worked on my bachelor's degree in creative writing, and I had to go slower than my peers. So coming back was strange because I was still a very young woman at 24, 25, but I was in classes with people who were a few years younger. Or sometimes, you know, if somebody that's 18 and then you're 25, that's a pretty big age difference. But I felt so old. I had seen so much. And so I didn't understand how people could sit on their phones in class while the instructor was up there. And I'm like, I want to make you all do push-ups because you're not listening to the authority in the room. It was like all these things that I had learned, I had to slowly unlearn them because they didn't make sense in real life. It was almost like the army was my real life, but it doesn't. Some of those skills just don't equate to normal society, for lack of a better word. So there was a lot of struggle with that about identity, just layers and layers of that. But I clung to the things that were still true, which is that I love to learn and I love to write. So I leaned in really hard to that, but I wasn't able to do what I could before. I wasn't the same. So I wasn't very gentle with myself about that at first. I compared myself to my peers, but that really wasn't a fair comparison. On the one hand, it's like, you haven't seen what I've seen, right? But on the other, it's like, how can they blaze through these classes faster than I can? Yeah, it was a strange time to navigate all of that. But I kept going and I pursued my master's in creative nonfiction. And again, I wouldn't have been able to do that without the military. And slowly but surely, I found my way through. I did equine therapy. So that was a huge thing for me, was riding horses every week with other veterans. And there was a therapist on hand, and we would do a bit of talk therapy, and then we would ride horses. And so much came out of that program. And I stayed with them for 6 years, which was beautiful. I moved to Colorado because that's where the writing program was that suited me best. I bought a house because of my military benefits, and I had my dog, Sophie. She was a golden retriever, and I got her specifically to be a service dog, which in the States is much more of a thing than it is here. But I had read all these studies about how having that kind of a dog by your side at all times was better than any drug that you could take. And I was given all of them, you know, like at the start when I got back, but I found that they didn't work for me. And not to say that they can't for other people, but I just kept feeling further and further from who I felt like I was. But being with Sophie, my dog, brought me back to me. And it stopped being about just me. I had to get out of bed every day to make sure that she was okay. So I had her for 12 and a half years. And the first several, she was with me everywhere I went. I mean, the grocery store, doctor's appointments, she went to every class with me. And it wasn't that I needed her to like, you know, a seeing eye dog, like you know, they do different tasks. Her main thing was if she was with me, I was better. I was more calm. I was able to handle just the basics of life. So she was a huge part of my healing journey. And so, you know, you string enough of those things together, you know, the therapy, the education, the service dog, and a growing sense of community. I had really great people in Colorado and in California. And so the numbness that I felt after being in a war zone started to fade, and I came home to myself more and more and more. And then eventually, I feel like I might have skipped this in the timeline. My first time ever coming to Ireland was going through Shannon Airport on my way to Iraq.
Yeah, no, you did mention that, yeah.
So the second time was right after we got back from Iraq.
Okay.
And a handful of my friends, fellow soldiers, we came back for leave. And we did the most touristy thing. And we went to Dublin for St. Paddy's Day. And we went to the parade. And we were there in and around the city for 10 days. But that's all I saw. And that was in 2005. So ever since then, I've wanted to come back and see more. Because everybody I spoke to said, how could you go to Ireland and all you saw was Dublin? You missed the point. So it was a dream. I didn't know how or when, but I wanted to come back. And eventually, the more I healed and the more things started to open up for me, and I finished school and all of that, I felt ready to branch out beyond. I hadn't left the States since I got back from being in the Army. So from 2006 to 2017, I didn't leave the country. And I didn't even think about leaving the country. I just was this far off dream. But I started to realize that every time I left Colorado, it was to go to the sea. And I may not have always lived by the sea in California, but I could get there within the day. And that was maybe something that was just in my bones. And so I thought, man, it would be great. It's time. Let's go to Ireland. So I came over from holidays and I skipped Dublin and I returned to Shannon. And I flew in and out of there and went all over the place and left Dublin alone. I love Dublin, but I just left it that time. And when I got to Clare, that's when I got that strong sense. It was at the end of a 2-week holiday on my own that I could live here. And I loved it so much. It was just an incredible, like I said earlier, felt sense that I could make a life here. But it's one thing to love a place when you're on a holiday, and it's another to actually make a life there. So as soon as I got back to the States, I booked a small little cottage outside of Ennis-Dyman, and it was for the winter months. And I thought, if I can love it in those months, then I can love it all year. And so it was January, February, and March. And I brought Sophie, and we were here for 10 weeks together. And that's when I started to connect with people and the community and get this sense of a much deeper, just feel. It's one thing to have it be landscape-wise beautiful, but the community was beautiful too. It's like I didn't have to choose. I could have both. And I met other writers and musicians and artists, and you know yourself, like there's a lot happening here in this little small tucked in place. And the longer I stayed, the more I knew that this was where I wanted to be. I didn't know how I was going to make it happen, but that was what got it all started. And that's been in January, that'll be 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think we're on very similar-ish timelines. Like when I moved here, it was near enough. I'm trying to remember when we moved here. But
I remember when I first met you both.
Yeah, and the cheese press where everybody met.
Well, and one of the first times we really chatted was at one of the property management places locally.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We could do a whole podcast on property and what a fiasco and challenge it is. I'll leave that there. It's an increasing challenge in the area for various reasons. But yeah, I remember that now. So there obviously are, you know, there's a very settled, rooted, traditional community that live here as they do in all parts. But there's very much a I guess, a transient community, and then there's the other community that are the newcomers that are no longer transient that have stayed. And I have heard it said that maybe the integration isn't as great as it could be in terms of the two worlds, but I never really feel too much of a tension around any of that. It feels relatively harmonious. And maybe that's a testament to Clare people. There's like a real genuine, friendly welcome and appreciation. And perhaps part of that may come from the tradition of welcoming musicians into the county. And therefore, maybe that lends itself to welcoming creativity. And tourism, I'm sure, is a factor as well. Have you any thoughts on that?
Well, I feel like Clare people are incredible. And yeah, they're genuine and real. You know, if I could generalize, that's been my experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like if you're real and genuine, they respond, like attracts like in that way. And so nobody cares about necessarily what you make or what you drive or how you dress. It's who are you? And so if you're able to meet people and really show up as who you are, then I feel like that's responded to in kind. Mm-hmm. That's been my experience. And I mean, really, if you're sound, they want to keep you here, right? So yeah, maybe there's a long tradition of that, but I can only speak to what it's felt like for me. And I just feel like I've come alive in this place. And so the people that I met when I first arrived, I have friends that I met when I was on those holidays with stars in my eyes talking about moving here. And they're like, yeah, yeah, you and every other American that comes through Doolin and thinks this is like the best place ever. But now that I've actually done it and made it happen and they've watched me grow and evolve over time, I feel like they're rooting for me.
Yeah.
But there's this genuine sense of we're happy to see you make a life here. I've never had the sense of, we don't have room for you, you're taking from. It always is. I feel like I've been welcomed in terms of like, you're adding to the place. And that's really beautiful. I don't know that it would be like that in other places, but I know that that's how I've been received here in Clare. And I'm so grateful for that.
Mm, lovely. Maybe tell me a little bit about where your creative process is at these days and what is cooking and what you see maybe on the horizon.
Well, I launched a website about a year and 3 months ago, and that's been a huge game changer in terms of my process, because I have stacks and stacks of things written, and then I wouldn't necessarily ever share them. And this has been a fire, you know, in my belly now that I am putting things out there on a regular basis because of the website. So there was a push against deadlines and grades and pressure because school can kind of squish the creative process, which is a funny thing to say when you study creative writing, but that's how I felt. And I think there was a bit of burnout and just a reaction to being in that system. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for it because of what I learned, and I was grateful to be done with it.
Yeah.
So then there was a stretch of time where I didn't know how to create unless other people were giving me feedback. And that was an important phase as well. So for example, I was a part of the Northern Clare Writers Group and I loved it. And this was just before COVID hit, you know, we would meet up in a little pub and have our conversations and share work. And there's a great thing that happens from that type of community and collaboration. And I realized over COVID that there was a need in me to go off on my own and create pieces and edit them myself and process them myself and know that they're not perfect and perfect doesn't exist, but I've learned to embrace them being done enough. And that's really powerful, that I don't need to workshop every single thing that I do and ask five people to give it a, you know, look and edit it and all of that. It's a sense of trusting that I know what I'm doing and I know what I want to say. And so that's where I'm at in my process, is that I'm writing pieces that hit really close to the bone But by the time I share them, I've made peace with the content. So then how they're received, it's not that it's none of my business, but it's like a bonus on top of what I've already done within myself. And so I love like that sense of connecting further with things that I've experienced and things that I am still trying to grapple with and understand, and then making peace with them and that them being done enough. And then finding out that some specific story I tell about being in Iraq, that maybe somebody could never imagine being in that position, but they get the feeling behind it. Mm. And it resonates with some life experience that they've had. And then they'll share that with me and say, oh, when I read this, it brought this up for me. Mm. I love when that happens right there. That's community. That's connection. So it's not why I write, but it is it's like a beautiful part of the process that I can't make happen. And yet it still continues to happen over and over again. And it couldn't before in earlier times in my writing career because I wasn't sharing anything. So I feel like I've opened myself up more and I'm more vulnerable now than I ever was able to be. And it just keeps getting better and better and juicier. And I'm just having fun not knowing what's coming next. And like, I have a deadline in probably about a month and I have no idea what I'm going to write yet. And I love that, but it will come. So that's where I'm at with things these days, letting it flow.
Great. Can you maybe reveal a little bit about what the deadline is for, or is that maybe best unsaid?
Well, it's for my website. It's a self-imposed deadline.
Oh, it's a self-imposed deadline.
Yeah, and see, that's a bit of what I'm getting at, is I didn't have those before.
Yeah. And any aspirations in terms of futuristic thinking or?
Well, for the longest time, I feel like a lot of writers, I was very much obsessed with getting published as a means of validation. And I still have elements of that with me. And rightfully so, being published is amazing. Do you remember when your book came out and I saw you at the cheese press and you were opening the box like holding it in your hand for the first time? That's still a dream of mine. I can't wait to have that moment. It's going to be beautiful. And so I keep writing my stories and I have enough now for a book. You know, it's a collection of short pieces that all come together and tell a larger narrative. What I don't have is an agent or a publisher, but I will. And so I put myself out there. I've got my proposal all done and ready. And every so often I send it out. And that's kind of where I'm at in my life, but it's reflected in my writing. I do my part and then I let go and I repeat as many times as necessary. So yeah, someday I'd love to have a published book and go on tour and talk to all the people and swap stories and feel that beautiful connection with a live audience. You know, I've done lots of readings. That's one of my favorite parts about this work, this writing work, is reading to people, whether it's in real life or not. But I feel like right now, this special time, it's very sacred because with agents and book deals and all of that comes a different layer of, I don't want to say pressure, but it's a different buzz, isn't it? So I'm free right now and I'm getting to go at my own pace and all of that, which feels really lovely. And I feel like I said, that's sacred, but I can feel that later it will change. And more distant, I could see Professor Tara, you know, with a bit of gray in her hair, talking about all these things to young minds and hopefully inspiring others to tell their story. Because, I mean, don't you feel like everybody has a story to tell? Like, not everybody wants to write about it, but a lot of people do, even if nobody else sees it. So, and that's another piece too, is that I'm about to start working with Fighting Words, and I'm all lined up and signed up and vetted and everything. And my first workshop is in a few weeks. And I can't wait.
Excellent. To go
work with kids and get them excited about the same thing.
Oh, like, that's great.
So that's the piece that I wanted to say as well, is that I feel like a lot of your work for a long time now has been about community and helping people, you know, in a broader sense. Whereas I can tell in my journey, it took a long time to heal and get out of survival mode and to work my way to where I'm at now, and then pivoting. And it needs to not just be about me. And it's like, how can I help others? Mm-hmm. And I'm ready for that to be part of the dream and the future and the vision going forward. So, and if this is something, you know, that I'm so passionate and I love so much, like if I can share that with others, I feel like it'll shine brighter than, say, I don't know, going to war and trying to help people. This might actually be a better fit. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The power of the word versus the power of the gun.
That's it. That's it.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Tara, for sharing all of that with me. And I'm looking forward to the book or the books and the lectures and the future multitudes of podcasts. But I think you captured something very well there, because a lot of people aspire to the great sort of elevated heights of having the thing and doing the thing, but actually it's the process of that is actually way more rewarding than the destination.
Absolutely.
In many ways. And it's great that you have that sense and you're cherishing it. So onwards and upwards.
That's it. I mean, it's a dream to be safe enough to be able to like write in peace and calm. Because I know that it's not always that way, and I have that now. And I hope that I always do, but just to have made it this far where I get to do what I do every day, it really does feel like a privilege.
Yeah. Mm. Lovely. Thank you, Tara.
Thank you.
Hello, Rory McKiernan here again. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. Please do consider sharing it amongst friends and people you think might be interested and help it get out into the world, reach more people. And don't forget to check out the archive for more great conversations. A big thanks also to Creative Ireland Clare for their support. And remember, I have another podcast you might enjoy. It's called the Love and Courage podcast. Some great conversations in there also. You can find me, Rory McKiernan, on various social media platforms and over at rorymckiernan.com. That's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Until next time.